From KBIA, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The midterm election is tomorrow. Four amendments will be on the statewide ballot, and Republicans will look to maintain their veto-proof majority in the state legislature. One of the contested races generating some buzz is right here in mid-Missouri. There are also two local proposed propositions and a few races for Congress in mid-Missouri. Today on Intersection, we'll tell you what you need to know before heading to the polls tomorrow and talk a bit about the impact some of these races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is senior city editor at the Missourian. Scott, welcome to Intersection.
Glad to be here.
And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. David, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do so.
We'd also love to hear from you and our audience today. What questions do you have about the election tomorrow? Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. You might have noticed in that intro that I didn't mention any major statewide races. That's because the only one that is up this year is for the state auditor. And Republican Tom Schweik, the incumbent, is running, and he's not opposed by any Democrat in that race. David, that's pretty unusual for a statewide issue.
That is right. And just to tell you how unusual this is, it's been 24 years back to 1990 since Missouri last had a ballot in which there was no election for either a president, U.S. senator, or governor. That leaves the auditor candidate as the top person on the ballot all by himself, and then even he doesn't face a challenge from the state Democratic Party. He's a Republican, of course. So it really is a pretty rare free ride for Tom Schweik.
Yeah, and he is facing a Libertarian and Constitution Party candidate, we should say.
Yes.
Yeah. And so again, that's very unusual. So instead, we're looking to statewide. We have a few of these constitutional amendments on the ballot. And then again, we're going to be looking more at local races as well. So why don't we start with those amendments? Why don't we start with Amendment 3? That's kind of an interesting one. David, you could help us with that a little bit. It deals with teacher evaluations and would make some significant changes if it went into effect.
Right, and we thought that this was going to be a pretty big deal on the ballot when it first got introduced. That's because it was being backed by a group called Teach Great, which is financed by Rex Singfield, of course, Missouri's most prominent political donor. As recently as Labor Day, they were promising to put a big effort into this, which when Rex is involved means millions of dollars in TV ads, usually.
Maybe a blimp.
A blimp, yeah, they went forward with the blimp. That's actually a different Rex-funded group. But the blimp happened, but the ballot measure did not get financed. They had done some polling internally and found out that their support was not that strong, and so they called off their advertising campaign. But the measure still appears on the ballot. And what it would do is it would require teacher evaluations to be based largely on student performance data. That means probably we're talking about standardized test scores. So the teacher's salary, whether they keep their job, whether they get fired, would all in large part be based on how well their students score on tests. Now, the ballot measure also would limit teacher tenure protections. Right now, if you work for 5 years at a school district in Missouri, you would then after that essentially have an indefinite contract. This would put a cap on that, I believe, limit contracts to no more than 3 years. So it would have some pretty substantial changes to the way public school teachers work in Missouri.
Yes, and as you mentioned, really no vocal opposition in the lead up to the election. So we don't have a lot of really even understanding about what the arguments for this would be. I guess when there was some activity on that side. What were the purposes of this in the first place, I guess, for those that were for it, I guess, supporting it?
Right. So it's forth as a way to bring more accountability to school districts, to ensure that students are learning, you know, that you wouldn't end up with a teacher who, their students may not actually be performing that well, but because they have tenure, they're just in that spot indefinitely. At least that was their idea. It is opposed, I should say, by pretty much every public education group there is in Missouri.
Yeah, no lack of opposition, that's for sure, including
teachers,
Columbia.
Teachers, administrators groups are all against it, and they have spent some money running their ads telling people to vote no, even though there's no money on the other side saying vote yes.
Because ultimately, it's still on the ballot. It's still up for vote.
That is right. It is still there, and it is Amendment 3 on the ballot.
Right, right.
I think a couple of the main arguments against this are that it would take away local control of how school districts evaluate their teachers, because you would have to submit your evaluation program to the state for approval. And there's also some stomach aches about basing so much of a teacher's evaluation on how their students do on standardized tests.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily a new complaint either, but right. To reiterate that with a new constitutional amendment would definitely irritate some teachers even more on that idea. Mm-hmm. Well, let's run through a few of the other amendments. They're all a little we don't have any major issues. Again, we thought Amendment 3 might be one of the major ones, but these other ones are a little smaller. Amendment 6 would create early voting, at least a version of early voting here in the state. David, maybe help us with what the specifics would be on that.
Right. So Amendment 6 would create a 6-day early voting period. And the fact it's called Amendment 6 with a 6-day early voting period is actually just coincidence. But that early voting period would end the Wednesday before the election. So you would have people voting on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. They would not be able to vote early on the weekend. Then they could vote again Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of the following week, and then not again on that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday leading up to the election on Tuesday. So it's a early voting period that would be allowed, but not on weekends and not after hours, only during business hours, only at the main county local jurisdiction where the voting offices are. And it would only happen if it's funded by the legislature and the governor. So that is all a way of saying that even if voters pass this, there is no guarantee that they will be voting early in the next general election in 2016, because it still might not get funded and still could end up not happening even if it does pass.
Right. And so, yeah, in your description there, we did highlight some of the possible criticisms there. Is there anything else that people are critical of here? Obviously, it would cost some money as well.
Yeah, there would be a cost involved. And for those people who are advocates of early voting, some of them would contend that this isn't a very generous early voting period. It was developed by Republican legislators when this spring there was an initiative petition proposed that would have had a much more expansive early voting period that was backed by some Democratic aligned groups. That measure would have allowed 6 weeks of early voting, including on weekends and after normal business hours. And the Republican legislators were fearful of that attempt, thought it was too much, and so came up with this more limited attempt as an alternative. Well, as it turns out, the initiative petition didn't get enough signatures to make the ballot, so the more expansive option is not going before voters, and what they're left with is the more limited option.
I need to take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The midterm election's tomorrow, and today we're talking about what you need to know before heading to the polls tomorrow and talking a bit about the impact some of the races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is senior city editor at the Columbia Missourian. And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. And for you and our audience, what do you think of the amendments on the November ballot? Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We also want to mention that here at KBIA, we just launched a new tool you can use to easily search through legislators' voting records and campaign contributions. It'll help you as you prepare to vote tomorrow. You can find it by going to kbia.org. The project is called Access Missouri, and you can also find it at accessmissouri.org. So a few of those two other amendments, we'll run through those relatively quickly because they're somewhat straightforward, but also a little confusing. Amendment 2 would allow propensity evidence to be used in sexual assault trials involving children. So kind of unusual for this to be a constitutional amendment, David, but how would this affect the way those trials may be tried?
Well, what this would do is create an exception to the rule of how things normally operate in court. Let's take, for example, you're charged with murder. Well, in court, they cannot usually bring up the fact that you were once accused of an unrelated murder in an entirely different case when they're trying to convict you of this other case. Okay? The same thing happens with sex abuse cases right now. As it stands, you currently cannot bring up allegations that John Doe was previously accused of molesting kids when he's facing a totally unrelated charge for molesting kids that didn't involve the same circumstances or the same kids. So this would change that. It would create an exception only for sex abuse cases where the victim is a minor, and it would allow a court to decide whether to allow into evidence other allegations of child sex abuse, for example. The idea from prosecutors who support this is that sometimes you'll have a defendant and you have a child witness. Child witnesses are very difficult to be able to use in court. And if you're able to show that there was a pattern, that even if this person hasn't been convicted previously, they had six allegations against them, they would argue that that should be allowed to be used in the case at hand. So that is what that's all about, and that's Amendment 2 on the ballot.
Right. And notably, like you mentioned it there, but it's not just cases that were actually convicted of, because that's also not allowed currently. Those convictions are only allowed to be introduced after in the sentencing phase when they're trying right. to determine the sentence. So the fact that you could include simple allegations is something that has got some opposition. I think the ACLU notably has even been opposed to this for that reason, because it may infringe on people's rights, they would argue.
Yeah, there are some defense attorneys that don't like this, but there has not really been a traditional campaign on either side of it. I mean, there's not TV ads about it, so it's sort of an under-the-radar issue.
Right. Finally, let's get through this last amendment, Amendment 10. This one may be very hard to pin down the impact for a lot of voters, because it seems very inside baseball and the way things work at the legislature. And David, that's a big part of your job, is inside baseball at the legislature, I think, sorting that out for people. So what would Amendment 2 do if it were to pass?
Right. So let's talk about first the way things operate. Right now, the legislature passes a budget. The governor signs the budget. Or the governor can issue line item vetoes on some budget items if he wants. The governor right now also has another option, and that is to sign the budget and then say, although I approve this budget, I am not going to allow money to be spent on this particular item. The governor says oftentimes it's because we don't have enough money in the bank to do so, or I am concerned that we might not have enough money to do so. It's what they call a spending restriction. Well, right now, the legislature, by a two-thirds vote, can override a line item budget veto, but the legislature has no way to reverse a governor's spending restriction. What this would do is allow the legislature to override a governor's spending restriction just as they can currently a line item budget veto. Now, there's arguments to be made on both sides of that. The governor says that is limiting his constitutional powers, and he's the one responsible for balancing the budget. It should be his final decision. Lawmakers think that they should have that say because they're the ones chiefly designed with drafting the budget. So it largely comes down to who do you want to have the final say when it comes to spending money, the governor or the legislature?
And it's not that unusual. The governor has been withholding some of these. Sometimes some would argue for political reasons when things are being sorted out down there. It's not become a really unusual circumstance for these withholdings to be taken into place, with the understanding that if something is to happen, if a certain action happens in the legislature, this money will then be released.
Right. The governor has withheld a couple of billion dollars since he took office in 2009, and he currently has spending restrictions on more than $700 million. What really got legislators fired up on this is over the past couple years, the governor has used this power of spending restrictions to block items on the assumption or as leverage to guard against legislators overriding his vetoes on other bills, for example, tax cuts. You know, the legislature passed a tax cut. The governor is fearful that could harm funding for public schools, and so he enacts spending restrictions that he will allow to be released only if the legislature sustains his veto on a tax cut. So that is sort of behind the scenes what led to this constitutional amendment.
There's also some concerns, at least the opponents are saying that this could affect, or I'm sorry, supporters are saying this could affect the credit rating if this were to pass, the state's credit rating, if you know, this ability to balance the budget becomes a little more cumbersome.
That's an argument that the governor has made against the amendment, actually. That being, if it's a little unclear who has the final say on budget, and if it increases the likelihood that the budget becomes unbalanced, well, Moody's or whatever doesn't like to see a state with an unbalanced budget, and states that have budget troubles get lower credit ratings, which means they get worse interest rates on their loans. So that is an argument that's been made. We're getting pretty inside baseball now, yeah.
Yep, that's for sure.
You know, the Missouri Club for Growth is one of the biggest proponents of this, and this is another Rex Sinkfeld-funded organization. And it does have a couple of Columbia board members, Larry Schuster and Kat Cunningham, so they're backing this thing pretty heavily. But I think it's also, you know, it seems like a situation where we might be playing politics with the Missouri Constitution. So I know at the Missourian we've reported that there are some Republicans who are warning that if this passes, Republicans themselves might regret it once a Republican governor is in place.
Yeah, it is kind of unusual, I guess. Maybe not unusual is the word, but it's becoming more common for these constitutional amendments to be put out instead of, you know, some other sort of legislative change. Is there any reason we can pinpoint that, Scott or David?
David might be better versed at that, but I would say, you know, going back to Amendment 6, that's the primary reason that our Boone County Clerk, Wendy Noren, opposes Amendment 6. She's a big advocate of early voting, but she doesn't think it has any business being enshrined in the Constitution. Maybe David can reflect a little bit on this move toward amending the Constitution rather than the General Assembly simply passing legislation that it thinks is warranted.
Sure. There's a couple things to note. This Amendment 10 about budget powers we're talking about, that has to be a constitutional amendment because those are spelled out in the Constitution. But as he was mentioning, Amendment 6 on early voting, there's no particular reason that would have to be in the Constitution. Right now, the legislature could merely pass a bill, a law, allowing early voting if they wanted to. When you put something in the Constitution, it makes it harder to change. First of all, if you're an interest group out there that wants to get an initiative petition and put something on the ballot, you have to gather more signatures to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot than you do just a regular change in law. So there is a higher hurdle to change it. Now, when it comes to voting, it still just takes a simple majority for this to pass among the people. So it's not like there needs to get a higher percentage to pass a constitutional amendment amongst the public than a change in law. But it does require a statewide vote, whereas a change in law can be done by the legislature. And when you have a statewide vote, it requires a higher number of signatures to qualify something for the ballot. So a constitutional amendment is really a way to enshrine whatever your favorite issue is into the Constitution and make it harder for others to change down the road.
Sure. And as you mentioned, it's a simple majority here. In some states, it is a two-thirds majority, just the way that Missouri does it.
Correct.
Yeah. So I want to remind our audience again, this is KBIA's Intersection. I'm Ryan Femuliner. The midterm election's tomorrow, and today we're talking about what you need to know before heading to the polls tomorrow and talking a bit about the impact some of the races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is a senior city editor at the Missourian. And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. What local races are you interested in this November? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at IntersectKBIA. We'd like to remind you can listen to Intersection during our live conversations on Monday afternoons at 2 on the air or streaming at KBIA.org. You can also join our online chat by going to KBIA.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at KBIA.org. Okay, so we should go ahead and move on to a couple things local voters are going to see on the ballot, Proposition 1 and 2. Let's start with Proposition 1, Scott, if you could help us with that a little bit. This is something that has been talked about for a few years now, how to fund more police officers. This would also fund firefighters. So this is what the city has come up with and tried to ask voters for here.
Yeah, that's right. Proposition 1 would increase the city's property tax levy by 30 cents. And it would phase it in 6 cents a year for each of the next 5 years. And it's intended to provide about $6 million once it's fully implemented. And they would use that money to hire 40 new police officers and 15 additional firefighters. It's worth noting this would be the first property tax increase in Columbia since 1987, which is a long time ago, 27 years by my math. And the city historically has kept property taxes pretty low. Right now they're at 41 cents per $100 assessed valuation. And that's primarily because the city has always seen property tax as sort of the territory for school districts, library districts, that sort of thing. But increasingly, sales tax, which the city traditionally has relied on as its sole source of revenue, not sole source, but primary, it's becoming volatile as more people buy things on the internet. The recession caused people to consume less. So they're looking at property tax as a much more stable way of funding what they see as a very real need. For those who are trying to figure out how this would affect them, if you were the owner of a $200,000 house, this would cost you $114 a year once it's fully implemented. So, again, this would be used to hire 40 new police officers and 15 new firefighters. The idea behind the need for additional police officers, some folks say we've got a real problem with crime here in town, and that the only way to really get a handle on that is to get more police, which in turn would allow the Columbia Police Department to do more proactive community policing, as we've seen the police department try to do in the Douglas Park neighborhood for the past couple of years. This is officers out of their cars, on foot, roaming around neighborhoods, touching base with people, trying to become known faces in the community, trying to develop a level of trust. Whereas what the city folks would tell you now is that police officers spend the vast majority of their time on patrol, zipping from one call to the next, without any time to do any of that community policing, or heck, for that matter, to even watch for traffic violations. They've got a thing they call zero status, when every officer who's on patrol is actively responding to a call. If you get more calls, you've got nobody to dispatch to those things. And that happens with some degree of regularity from time to time during a given week. So right now, Columbia's police force is at 1.4 officers per 1,000, which is below the national average. At the Missourian, we did a comparison with some comparable college towns, and we found that that number is not completely out of whack. I'll be honest and say what we didn't take into account, that number doesn't include the number of MUPD officers we have in town. So that would be a good thing to know, that we didn't quite nail that down at the Missourian, but worth noting. So it also contains money, if it passes, for 15 additional firefighters. We've got a situation in Columbia where we have a fire station over on Worley Street, fire station number 2, that is not fully staffed. It's only fully staffed about 45% of the time. And so when Station 2 gets a call, it has a ripple effect with other stations, and it can cause real problems with response times or getting adequate numbers of firefighters to various emergencies. And the other thing that's going on with the fire department is that as Columbia's boundaries have expanded, you know, we have 9 fire stations, can't build a fire station every other day. So as those boundaries expand, it becomes more and more difficult for the fire department to respond within that national standard of 4 minutes. We have outlying areas of the city where it's nearly impossible to get there within 4 minutes. So those are the things that that this proposition is intended to address. This has been endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce. There's a Yes for Public Safety committee that has formed to campaign for it. The mayor obviously is a huge advocate of this and has spent some time going out and campaigning for it. No real organized opposition, but the folks who have spoken up on this issue say, you know what, police and fire protection is such a basic city function that you shouldn't have to find earmarked money or ask the voters to approve earmarked money for that. It ought to be something that you're funding from your general fund. Mm-hmm. So those are sort of the arguments for and against this. Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, you could make an argument that perhaps they should have separated police and firefighters and made them different issues. Not that I'm in the business of advising the city on political matters. But so you've got to make a decision, you know, do you think 40 new police officers is a good idea or not?
Yeah. So. And again, this is something that's been discussed for really since last year, around the time that Mayor's Crime Task Force was founded. And you know, I think the city manager has said, you know, if this doesn't happen, maybe we add a police officer or two every year or so. But they haven't been adding many officers in recent past. You mentioned the sales tax problem.
Yeah. They have, I think, in most budget years, managed to add one or two officers. And you got to keep in mind that you don't just hire a guy and put him to work. You also have to equip him. You got to give him a car or her, excuse me. You've got to train them. So the expense goes far beyond the salary for that police officer.
The value I've seen is estimated around $100,000 a year is
right.
What it comes down to for that entry-level officer.
Yeah.
Want to move on to Proposition 2 here. We've got a few minutes before we go to the break. This is a proposed increase on the fees that would hit development here in Columbia, in which, of course, we talk about development in Columbia, you're going to get a lot of interested people in the topic.
Absolutely.
But what exactly would this do, and how? What are the opinions on this
one? It might take me all the way to the break just
probably
to describe what it would do. This is a proposed increase in development fees. Right now, the city charges new developments 50 cents per square foot. It's a flat fee, no matter if you're building a house or if you're building a Walmart. And that increase went into effect in 2005. It was phased in. Our development fees used to be 10 cents per square foot. They gradually increased to 50 cents. What this proposition would do is increase those fees to $1 per square foot for residential construction, $1.50 per square foot for low-impact commercial construction, and $2 per square foot for high-impact non-residential construction. So low impact, it's all tied to the number of vehicle trips that your project generates. So if you're building a Walmart, more vehicles are going to be traveling the streets to get to your place, so that would be considered a high impact thing. So the whole rationale here is the proponents say developers are not paying a high enough share of the cost for the new streets that their projects make necessary. If you build a Walmart, people have to be able to get to it. And right now, when the city builds new streets, developers are funding about 15% of that cost. Proposition 2 would increase that to an estimated 35%. So there are great arguments for and against this. I don't know if you want to save those till after the break, or maybe I can get into
Well, we have about a minute left. One of the big things is that the criticism is this might fall back on consumers, that maybe pass down if these fees cost higher for developers, it's just going to cost the regular folks more, whether it's a house or a local product, things like that.
Sure. I mean, that's a common argument. Anytime you put increased costs on developers, they probably are likely to pass that on to their consumers rather than simply absorb them, and I think that might particularly be true with residential construction. You know, if you're paying higher fees to build a house, then the price of that house might go up. I think it's a harder argument to make when you're talking about huge developments like Walmart shopping centers or malls or that sort of thing. I haven't done the math, but the thousands that would in development fees that you would pay, it would be hard to see that might increase the cost of a dress that you go out and buy or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there have been some criticisms of developments that have been going on, and they're not paying their fair share of infrastructure improvements. We've seen that with a lot of the developments downtown as well. So that's another side
sure,
of this.
Sure.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break right here. This is KBIA's Intersection. I'm Ryan Femuliner. The midterm election's tomorrow, and today we're talking about what you need to know before heading to the polls and talking about the impact some of the races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is a senior city editor at the Columbia, Missouri. And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. I'm Ryan Femuliner. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to KBIA's Intersection. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The midterm election is tomorrow, and today we're talking about what you need to know before heading to the polls and talking about the impact some of the races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is senior city editor at the Columbia Missourian. And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. And for you and our audience, what questions do you have about the election tomorrow? Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you can join our online chat. And so before we move on to some of these races, Scott, we were going to talk, we had to kind of cut off the talk about Proposition 2 there. There still is some other, the people that are for this amendment or are opposed to the passage of this amendment would say that this could limit the amount of development going on in town.
Sure. The development community is firmly aligned against this, and I suppose that's fairly predictable. They've got a committee called Citizens for a Better Columbia that has raised a lot of money to do some advertising against this. And some of your readers might notice their mailbox is full of some direct mail from these folks. A big part of their argument is not only that this is going to increase costs on Columbia residents in general, but also that it might push development out of the community altogether. Some folks say folks will be more likely to develop out in the county rather than in the city because of the higher development fees. And others, including Mayor McDavid, argue that larger developments might just shun Columbia altogether because of these fees. You know, we've done some looking into this in other communities at the Missourian, and we largely find that those arguments are not true. Folks say, if they've had any sort of dip in development lately, it's been because of the recession and not because of fees, which are much higher in a lot of other communities than they are in Columbia, even if this proposition were to pass. So, and then you've got on the supporting side of this, you've got a committee called Cost Sharing for Quality Roads. It's largely led by Third Ward Councilman Carl Scala, who really was a strong advocate for putting this on the ballot, and a gentleman out there, a private citizen by the name of Ben Londeray, who has been studying the costs of infrastructure in Columbia and other communities for many years. The Chamber of Commerce has voted not to endorse this. The Central Missouri Development Council voted not to endorse this. Regional Economic Development, Inc. crafted a letter of concern about the potential impact on development. So it's a very controversial issue. Folks will have a tough decision to make there.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on to some of the races. We haven't talked about any people yet. We've talked about issues so far. So starting at the top of the list, there's not a ton to talk about. Again, no statewide races. U.S. senators are not up this time around. We do have a couple of U.S. congressional races here in our area. Vicky Hartzler, the Republican incumbent in the 4th District, is going to be facing Nate Irvin, a young challenger in that district. Boone County is part of that district now. That changed recently. I guess David may help us with that. That Nate Irvin is a very young challenger, newcomer to politics.
Right. And much like the other races around the state, the 4th District does not have a very high likelihood of seeing the incumbent defeated.
Yeah, the spending total so far, not that spending is everything. Vicky's raised around $800,000, spent $530,000 on her campaign. Irvin's raised $12,000, spent around that much on his campaign so far. So definitely outmatched in that area anyway.
And I believe Representative Hartzler lost only one county the last time she ran back in 2012, and that was Boone County.
Yeah, yeah. And so, again, she's more or less ignored Irvin for most of the campaign, hasn't been spending much time talking about him, instead just talking about the ideal she stands for. Same for Irvin. Sorry, go ahead.
Probably worth noting also that Herschel Young is a libertarian from Harrisonville who's making his second bid for this office.
Right. And then in the 5th District, we have Blaine Lukemeyer being challenged by Courtney Denton. Again, as you said, David, not really expecting to see an upset here necessarily. Lukemeyer has been a long-time incumbent.
Right, he has. And that's the 3rd District, which stretches from the Lake of the Ozarks up through Jefferson City over to the outer suburbs of St. Louis. But again, the Lukemeyer seems pretty set likely on winning re-election there.
Right. All right, let's go ahead and start going down the list. We mentioned in the open of this show that Republicans are going to continue to try to maintain their veto-proof majority there at the State House. We have, well, first we'll mention the races you don't have to worry about here in our area. We have three races that are where the candidates are running unopposed. Caleb Jones, a Republican, is running unopposed in the 50th District State House. And then two other state house seats here are also unopposed. Stephen Weber in the 46th, I think this will be his fourth term. And then Kip Kendrick in the 45th district in Chris Kelly's old seat, which is kind of interesting, Scott, that Kip's going to be running unopposed in his first time applying for a statewide office.
Yeah, you know, that's traditionally been a Democratic district, even though it's been redrawn. But I do find it rather surprising that the Republicans didn't decide to field a candidate against somebody who's never held political office.
Right. So while Republicans didn't bother there, they did bother in the right to try to take down John Wright. So David, maybe you can help us a little bit with that. Chuck Basie is going to be taking on John Wright here in our area. And the Republicans are throwing up some money behind Basie to try to make this challenge.
They have put a lot of money into that race. And part of the reason is it's a district that could be a swing district. And another part of the reason is that some Republicans look at Wright as a potential up-and-comer who may have bigger ambitions than just serving in the state house and would like to give him a tough challenge at the ground level before he starts moving up the political chain.
Which I suppose could make some sense that, you know, he's only got one term under his belt at this point, you know, not quite necessarily established with name recognition and all that in the area quite yet.
Right. There's a general sort of political train of thought that says if you're going to be able to defeat an incumbent, the best time to do it is at their first reelection. In other words, they're a freshman, they're running for reelection. This is the time to try to defeat them. If they win, then they're likely locked in for the next couple terms.
Yeah, and the 47th is a very interesting district in terms of the way it's drawn. It includes quite a bit of western Boone County, including a slice of northwestern Columbia. But much of it is very rural. It includes parts of Cooper, Howard, and Randolph counties. So it's going to be really interesting how this shakes out, whether John Wright can win enough of the Columbia and the rest of the vote to overturn what Chuck Basie might be able to do in those rural areas.
Yeah, and Chuck Basie, I know the ads I've seen maybe play to that. He's baling hay and that kind of thing.
Exactly. He's a farmer out near Roachport. Actually, both these candidates live in the Roachport area. Wright is, they couldn't have much different backgrounds. Wright is a very successful investment manager, spent some time with Goldman Sachs in New York and some other investment firms, started his own company, Rollins Capital Management. He's been a big advocate of early childhood education, and one of the main things he's campaigning on is lobbyist reform. He's taken a pledge against accepting any gifts from lobbyists, and he wants some caps on campaign contribution limits. But yeah, Basie is he's a farmer who grows produce on a small farm out near Roachport, a former air traffic controller, and it seems from his campaign messages like he would be a very reliable Republican vote.
Yeah. Again, both these candidates have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars at this point, actually relatively well matched when it comes to money spent. But one thing notable, John Wright's spending largely self-funded.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the means to do it. And if you're going to campaign on a platform of limiting campaign contributions and that sort of thing, probably a good thing if you're going to spend your own money rather than everybody else's. Chuck Basie is getting a lot of help from the House Republican Campaign Committee. And the money keeps pouring into both those campaigns, even with the election being tomorrow. It's pretty remarkable.
Right. And then the other contested race we can move on to here in our area, Caleb Rowden in the 44th District is going to be challenged by Thomas Pauley, Rowden, the incumbent Republican, and Pauley, a challenging Democrat. And so, yes, this race, not quite the same amount of money being spent on Pauley's side as we're seeing for Rowden so far, Scott.
Yeah, that's right. Last time I checked, I think Mr. Pauley had somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000. I don't have the number right off the top of my head, whereas Representative Rowden had well in excess of $150,000. But I don't think he's spending a whole lot of that money, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Caleb is going for his second term in the House. Again, a pretty reliable Republican vote. Although we've talked to him, he stands behind ethics reform. He's actually filed an ethics reform bill and intends to do so again. So he's interested in seeing some limits on campaign contributions, lobbyist gifts, that sort of thing.
And, yeah, again, also a relatively young guy, 32 years old.
Former Christian rock musician. And, heck, I've gone to YouTube and listened to some of his stuff. It was pretty good.
And then Tom Pawley, he's a financial consultant. Is that right?
Yeah, a former sheet metal worker. He's very active in his church. He's a member of the Hallsville Board of Aldermen. He's a veteran of several Democratic political campaigns. So you know, he's had his toe in the political waters for quite some time, and I guess decided he wanted to make his own run.
Right. And so, yeah, I wonder your thoughts, David, a little bit on just on these state legislature races, what Republicans are thinking, again, trying to keep their veto-proof majority. You know, they've targeted John Wright, maybe a few other races around the state, but how do Republicans feel about their chances at keeping that veto-proof majority?
Right. Well, let's put those in a little broader context, right? So the Republicans right now have 110 seats in the Missouri House. It takes 109 to have a two-thirds majority, which is what we call a supermajority or a veto-proof majority. The two-thirds mark is the vote you need to override vetoes. The Republicans have that just barely right now in both the House and the Senate. They would very much like to keep that because Governor Jay Nixon is still going to be governor for the next 2 years until his term ends, which means you have a Democratic governor and a Republican-led legislature. If you have a two-thirds majority, you have leverage to be able to override vetoes. So you may be well aware that this year there were a lot of vetoes overridden, both on regular bills that enacted an income tax cut, for example, and on line item budget vetoes. In almost all of those cases, the Republicans, although they had a supermajority, still picked up the votes of a few Democrats. So having a supermajority is not the be-all, end-all to being able to override vetoes, but they would really like to be able to push that number from 110 in the House up to, say, 113 or 114, because that gives you some leeway if you're the Republicans to have a member absent or to have a couple members who just don't agree with you philosophically and want to vote no, and they can, and you can still override a veto.
Are there many races that Democrats have made an effort to steal Republican seats, or are we mostly seeing the opposite?
Well, the Democrats have made an effort this election, and they've made more of a financial commitment than they have in years past. Senator McCaskill herself has put in about $600,000 from her own U.S. Senate campaign into the Missouri Democratic Party to be used in the state legislative races. And Attorney General Koster and Governor Nixon have also chipped in some money, as has Treasurer Zweifel. So the Democratic executives, their statewide offices, are putting more money into the party in the hopes of winning a few more state legislative seats this election, because just like Republicans want to bump that number up by a few, the Democrats want to knock it down by a few so that you can take those Republicans from 110 down to, say, 105 or something like that. And suddenly then the Republicans would have to reach out to Democrats a little bit more, perhaps compromise a little bit more if they wanted to get something that could pass with a veto-proof majority.
I need to take a moment to remind our audience, this is KBIA's Intersection. I'm Ryan Femuliner. The midterm election's tomorrow, and today we're talking about what you need to know before heading to the polls and talking a bit about the impact some of the races and issues might have. Joining me in studio today is Scott Swofford. He's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is senior city editor at the Missourian. And joining us by Skype, David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City. For you and our audience, what messages do you hope lawmakers hear this November? Let us know by giving us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We also want to mention here that at KBIA, we just launched a new tool you can use to easily search through legislators' voting records and campaign contributions. It'll help you as you prepare to vote tomorrow. You can find it by going to kbia.org. The project is called Access Missouri. You can also find it at accessmissouri.org. So we spent a lot of time, maybe more than I usually like, talking about money and money that's been spent. But there is a race that the money has made very interesting all of a sudden. David, you can help us with this one. Brian Stumpy is challenging Pat Joyce for the 19th District Circuit Court judgeship in the Cole County, Jefferson City area. And he's seen $200,000 from the Republican State Leadership Committee into that race, which is a huge amount of money for a judgeship race. So what's the situation there? Why is that happening?
Well, first, let's tell you, why does this race matter, right? Why would you be seeing big money in a race for a Cole County judgeship? Well, Cole County is the place where lawsuits have to be filed that involve the state of Missouri. So if you want to challenge a ballot measure, if you want to challenge a state law, you've got to file that lawsuit in Cole County because that's the seat of state government. So these circuit judges in Jefferson City are not just handling normal criminal cases and civil cases like child custody or divorce cases. They do those as well, but they also get involved in helping to decide the constitutionality of state issues. They're the first step in that process, granted. Most of these things get appealed from Cole County up to the appeals court and on to the state Supreme Court. But that tells you why there is a political interest in a judgeship in Cole County. So what has happened in this race is that there is a Democrat who's a judge who's been on the bench for a while. Her name is Pat Joyce. And there is a local Republican attorney who functions as the Jefferson City prosecutor. His name's Brian Stumpy in this election. A Republican group out of Washington called the Republican State Leadership Committee or something to that effect has put $200,000 into the race. It's given half of that to Stumpy, and it's spending the other half itself. And how it's spending the money is, it's stirring some interest, let's say. They've had some TV ads that are fairly negative. They've had some flyers that are mailed to people's homes that are fairly negative. And so there's just been a lot of attention focused on a race that probably most people weren't paying much attention to otherwise.
Yeah, and you mentioned it earlier. It's not that this activity that could affect the political sphere, you know, these ballot language challenges and things like that, are the primary job of this position. In fact, it's probably not even close to the primary job.
Absolutely not. Just like any judge around the state, you know, 95 to 98% of their workload is typical criminal and civil cases. But they do get those state law and state constitutional issues as part of their docket as well. So they are unusual in that regard, and that is why there's an interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, by comparison, and maybe we can use this by way of transition, but when folks campaign for judgeships here in Boone County, it's usually a very straightforward campaign focused on here are my qualifications, because state law is very restrictive about what candidates for judge can say. They can't make promises. They can't take stances on political issues, that sort of thing. So it's unusual to see this sort of a campaign in a judge race.
Yeah, again, wait.
I should note that the candidates for judge here in Cole County are not the ones that are out there
right
in the negative campaigning. They're following a pretty traditional, low-key judicial election where they talk about their own qualifications for the most part. It's the outside groups that have come in that have made the case a little bit unusual.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to running out of time, so I'm going to run through. We have a few other races to talk about here, mostly local races, actually. Scott, you can help us a little bit with the Recorder of Deeds race. It's kind of interesting. We have two co-workers running against each other for a job.
And in fact, in the August primary, you had three co-workers running for this job. What you have is a situation where the present Recorder of Deeds, Betty Johnson, is retiring after 35 years, and by and large, she's considered really one of the best Recorders of Deeds in the country, and especially in the state. And so the folks who have been working with her for years are seeking the opportunity to succeed her. So you have the Democrat, Nora Dietzel, and the Republican, Lisa Ballinger, who have been colleagues for... Well, Nora Dietzel's been working in that office for 18 years and Lisa Ballinger for 23 years. So, again, they've both run very straightforward campaigns, primarily focusing on their qualifications for the job. Neither one of them plans to make any tremendous changes in the office if they're elected. It's sort of like, you know, elect me because I've been working there for a long time and I know what the heck I'm doing, and I suspect both are telling the truth.
Sure. And then another one, the Boone County Presiding Commissioner is coming up, Dan Atwill versus Jimmy Pounds. And so Dan Atwill is currently in that position, correct? And mm-hmm. and it took over when after Ed Robb passed away.
Yeah, he was appointed by the governor when Ed Robb, who was a Republican, died back in 2011, and the governor was able to appoint a Democrat to replace him. And so this is the first time he was reelected. Once Ed Robb's term was up, he had to stand for reelection. This is the first time he's faced any opposition, though. And it's a really interesting race because Jimmy Pounds, this is the second time he's run for a county commission seat. Two years ago, he ran against Southern Boone County Presiding Commissioner Karen Miller and actually got 40% of the vote. And Mr. Pounds is an interesting character because he chooses not to form a campaign committee or to spend any significant amount of money on his campaign. He says he just doesn't feel right doing that. But, you know, he does take some stances on the issues. I think the main difference between these two candidates in terms of the issues is where they stand in terms of the Central Missouri Events Center, which most people know as the Boone County Fairgrounds. Voters might recall that in August the county asked them to approve a 1/8-cent sales tax that would have paid for improving, maintaining, and managing that property, marketing that property, and it went down in flames. So Presiding Commissioner Atwill believes that the county should retain ownership of that property, even though they're going to shut it down at the end of the year. And as he says, its time will come. As the city grows and actually encompasses the fairgrounds, its value as a recreational property, he would argue, is great. Jimmy Pounds says that if he is elected, he would vote to sell that property immediately. So that's a really stark difference that might resonate with folks, because I know people in Boone County feel really strongly one way or the other about the future of that fairground.
Yeah, and after it didn't pass in August, there was a lot of talk amongst the other county commissioners that the inevitable conclusion was that it was going to have to be sold or closed, shuttered
sure,
in some
and,
way.
Sure, and, you know, we haven't fully fleshed this out at the Missourian, but my understanding is that this is a problem that faces fairgrounds across the country, so we're going to eventually, I wish we would have done it by now, do some reporting that looks at what sorts of solutions other communities have come up with on these things.
Another big issue facing both of those, whoever's in this position, I should say, is the 911 call center. It's another big project that's coming up in the county.
Yeah, and that'll probably primarily be a management thing because voters have already approved a 3/8-cent sales tax to overhaul the way we do 911 and emergency management here in Boone County. It used to be under the purview of the City of Columbia. But with the approval of that sales tax, it became primarily a county responsibility. And a big chunk of that is to finance the construction of a new 911 and emergency management center out near the Boone County Jail. Not a whole lot for the candidates to say about this other than, you know, Mr. Atwill says, you know, I really want to make that a priority to see that through, to make sure it's done right. There's some talk about whether that center should become a regional resource where it could provide services to other counties. And Mr. Pounds would say, okay, I'm open to that as long as the other counties are paying their fair share. Because that building alone is going to cost about $14.5 million, according to the current estimate. And it's probably worth noting that when they campaigned for that sales tax, the estimated cost was somewhere a little over $11 million. So inflation, you know.
Sure. One more local race quickly to talk about here for a couple minutes. The Division 5 Associate Circuit Judge. This is a little bit more of a conventional judge race compared to the one we just talked about. Mike Whitworth and Kim Shaw.
It is. Kim Shaw has raised a lot of money to campaign for this compared to Mike Whitworth. But again, this has been a very straight-up campaign. Kim Shaw has got, she works in the public defender's office. She's got experience with that here. And in Cape Girardeau County, she spent quite some time working in the Capital Crimes Division for the Public Defender's Office, State Public Defender's Office. Mike Whitworth is a family law mediator who also handles lots of different civil types of claims with Ford, Parshall, and Baker here in Columbia. So this campaign has been all about, you know, just outlining what are your qualifications for the job. I think both candidates have done a very good job of doing that. So it'll just be a matter of who folks think is the better candidate.
Yeah, this is one of the few races we've talked about that wasn't, there's no incumbent. It was one that was vacated.
Yeah, Larry Bryson is stepping down after nearly 30 years on the job. He's been Republican Associate Circuit Judge for quite some time.
Sure. I wonder, Scott, we talked a lot. We ran through pretty much the entire ballot here.
We might really quickly mention the county collector. That's sure. Brian McCollum, a Democrat who has worked in the collector's office for 13 years, is running against Cherie Tolson Reich, who is the mayor of Hallsville. So that's one folks will want to consider,
sure.
too.
I wonder which of all these races we've talked about you're going to be following most closely.
Probably, even though I'm a local government geek, city and county government, I think the one that intrigues me most in terms of who the heck is going to win that thing is the John Wright-Chuck Basie race.
Yeah, and mainly just for that curiosity of who's going to take it. I mean,
yeah, and again, because, you know, I tend to get away from the horse race and look more at the potential impact it could have, what the demographics of the district might suggest is going to happen. And you can't help but pay attention to it if you know, the only thing I really watch on television is sports, but I still see these guys are on my TV many, many times per day. So, yeah, I'm interested in that one.
Right. What about you, David? I'm wondering which races you're following.
Well, ironically, the race I'm following the closest tomorrow is not even in Missouri.
that may say something.
I'm following the Kansas U.S. Senate race where there's an incumbent there named Pat Roberts, longtime Republican, being challenged by an independent candidate named Greg Orman. Now, Kansas has never elected an independent candidate to the Senate. That may not be surprising because that just doesn't happen every day. But Kansas hasn't even elected anyone besides a Republican to the Senate since 1932. And Orman has a pretty strong chance to be able to win this. So I'm watching that. And that is what I'm going to be focused on pretty heavily tomorrow.
Is there anything in Missouri? Are you also interested to see what Scott was mentioning, you know, just how some of these legislative races may change the landscape?
I am. I am interested to see how the Republicans fare or the Democrats fare in the whole contest for the supermajority. And that's decided on a case-by-case basis, but the numbers add up, and we will be watching that closely to see if they hit the 109 mark in the House and the two-thirds mark in the Senate as well.
Okay. I did want to mention we didn't get any calls today, but we did get a comment from Caleb Browden. Scott, he said thank you for the compliment on his music.
Oh, no problem. Folks should go check it out. No slight on his performance in the legislature, but I'm wondering why he gave that up. The guy was a star.
All right. Well, we're going to go and end it there for today. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks so much to our guest, Scott Swofford, an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and senior city editor at the Missourian, and David Lieb, a reporter with the Associated Press in Jefferson City, who joined us by Skype. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast, the Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 on Monday afternoon. You can also listen to the show live at that time as streaming audio at kbia.org, where you can also submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from the KBIA studios. We also like to mention that you should go to kbia.org, where you can find a new tool we just launched. You can easily search through legislators' voting records and campaign contributions. It'll prepare you as you go to vote tomorrow. It's called Access Missouri. You can also find it at accessmissouri.org. Intersections produced by Maureen Lewis Stump. Austin Federa is our technical director. Mike Dunn is the executive director. And I'm Ryan Femuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.